Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians, and the Making of the Bible by Candida Moss. Near the end of the Epistle to the Galatians, the Apostle Paul adds a comment on his clumsy penmanship. Look at what big letters I have written to you with my own hand. Rhetorically, it's a stamp of authenticity. Forged texts were common in the flux of early Christianity, so here is proof that Paul, who was possibly nearsighted, endorsed this message. It's also an arresting reminder that the epistle really was a letter and that the Bible really is a biblion, a papyrus and ink book, transcribed, at a minimum, by individual human hands. In God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians and the Making of the Bible, Candida Moss stresses the further implications of Paul's remark, ones that have often been overlooked. Like most writers in the Roman world, she points out, Paul mostly didn't write. The force of his aside comes from the fact that he didn't often take up a pen. He was making a special effort as a sign of his conviction. Instead, he dictated to skilled aides who, though euphemized as secretaries or amanuensis, were quite literally enslaved. Such workers, argues Moss, a professor of theology at the University of Birmingham, were more than mouthpieces, but co-authors, meaning-makers, missionaries, and apostles in their own right. Slavery was everywhere at Rome. Around the time of Christ, something like a quarter of the population of Italy was enslaved. In the countryside, enslaved people worked increasingly consolidated large farms. In the city, they filled innumerable roles created by the Romans' love of luxury, thirst for status, and sinister genius for hierarchical classification: cook, wet nurse, bookkeeper, colorator, which is a furniture polisher, a tabulus, a keeper of pictures, ab argento, keeper of silver, nomenclator, rememberer of guests' names, and dozens more. Among them were the scribes, readers, and messengers, who are Moss's main subjects. Tantalizingly, one appears by name in Paul's epistle to the Romans. I, Tertius, who wrote this epistle, greet you in the Lord. Tertius has the utilitarian ring of a servile name, Moss notes. It means third, but we get nothing beyond this glimpse, itself a rarity. In Roman society, slaves were non-people, living in what the historian Keith Bradley has described as a kind of death suspended at their enslaver's whim. Direct evidence for how such workers shaped the gospel and its reception is accordingly scanty, so Moss's account is necessarily and admittedly speculative. But she grounds her imaginative interpretations in close reading of secular and religious texts and the appalling facts of ancient slavery in general. Enslaved workers copied Christian manuscripts, cataloged them in libraries, and helped compile cross-references, indexes, and other aids for reading. They silently corrected faults in texts and chased down quotations in unwieldy scrolls. Even when taking dictation, Moss argues, they could play a meaningful part in composition. She cites another passage written by Paul, Romans 5:1, where some manuscripts have, "We have peace in God," and others have, "Let us have peace in God." The difference rests on a single character in Greek, omega versus omicron. The thing is, as Moss observes, the two letters, formerly distinct, had come to be pronounced the same by the time Romans was transcribed. Whichever reading was the original written text, it would have been a decision on the part of Paul's secretary, an unacknowledged bit of collaboration between the named author and his enslaved scribe. More speculatively, she notes the pervasive bookish language of Galatians, where enslaved people are twice referred to with a word that can also mean letters of the alphabet. This might be a way for Paul's scribe of inserting themselves into the letter, she suggests, a kind of in-joke. Perhaps they let slip a wry smile as they inscribed the words. Enslaved people helped spread the gospel as well as formulate it. Specialist lectores read, performed, biblical passages to Christians assembled for study and worship. Skillful improvisation by a lector might even explain the alternative ending to the Gospel of Mark, recorded in some manuscripts, Moss suggests. Couriers carried word from apostles to keep distant communities of nascent Christians on the same page, biblically speaking. Like ministers in the pulpit, Moss writes, these messengers were interpretive guides, ad hoc apostles who used gesture and intonation to supplement and explicate the text they carried. Artisans, women, and enslaved people also spread the Christian message through casual chatter. Not for nothing did pagans denigrate Christianity as a superstition of women and slaves. Moss goes on to cite a scene from Acts where the imagery of the Holy Spirit sweeping down on the apostles recalls classical tropes of gossip spreading like uncontrollable wind. Passages like that aren't a fluke, she writes, but reflect the consistent rooting of early Christian identity in the structures of slavery. To be a faithful Christian was to be a slave of Christ, like the Apostle Paul. Even biblical visions of hell, in Moss's reading, are influenced by the brutal working conditions for enslaved laborers in mines. Above all, slavish aspects can be seen in Jesus from his habit of speaking in parables, a lowly literary form resembling the fables of the enslaved Aesop, to his ambiguous parentage, much emphasized by Mark, who himself was sometimes cast as enslaved. Philippians goes further, outright describing Jesus as taking the form of a slave at birth. Moss shows how Christians have applied such rhetoric selectively ever since, sanitizing servitude into a metaphor. Moss's points about the disquieting ease with which some people use phrases like faithful servant, heedless of the ideological tangle of Christianity and slavery that underlies them, are well put. But occasionally she can be too eager to yoke past and present. She declares at the outset that she's not worried about anachronism, on the grounds that disinterested history is sometimes also morally negligent. Even so, her injections of modern rhetoric, essential workers, emotional labor, precarity, feels less subtle than the analysis that surrounds them. God's Ghostwriters is also less a cumulative argument than a string of case studies. But it brings the world of ancient slavery to grim life and connects larger issues of collaboration and credit to the material facts of ancient work, making it impossible to ignore the labor between the lines. This review was written by Timothy Farrington, who is a former editor at Harper's Magazine and The Wall Street Journal. Worry by Alexandra Tanner. In a much-memed scene from the second season of Fleabag, the protagonist is in the middle of confession with her hot priest crush and divulges a flash of what feels like genuine, abject self-discovery. "I just think I want someone to tell me how to live my life," she says. Now, picture the father is replaced by a mother, or better yet, a mommy. The confessional by a cell phone screen in a Brooklyn apartment. The 30-something British anti-hero by a 20-something Jewish American woman, and you can begin to imagine the essence of Alexandra Tanner's fabulously revealing debut novel, Worry. Jules is a 28-year-old aspiring writer from Florida with an MFA in fiction and a day job at a website that sells study guides of classic novels. In claustrophobic present tense, she candidly narrates the minutiae of her fixations, disappointments, aversions, and maladjustments as she navigates adulthood. At the risk of being too schematic, Jules's interests, beyond her efforts to achieve literary renown, can be boiled down to consuming Christian mommy social media content and critiquing her sister, Poppy. The former is symptomatic of a larger personal complex, Though Jules wants to be independent, she craves a matriarchal authority's approval, guidance, and comfort, perhaps because her own mother can be rejecting and inscrutable. In its more superficial manifestation, Jules's curiosity consists of scrolling the internet for hours each day, watching Instagram moms share conspiracy theories in all caps and hawk products. Poppy, younger than Jules by a few years, is following in her sister's footsteps. Having just emerged from a rocky early 20s, marked by short-lived professional prospects and mental health crises, she moves into Jules's spare room, begins working jobs similar to her sister's, and also starts an entertainment binge, watching episodes of Sailor Moon with Jules. Poppy suffers from chronic outbreaks of hives. Like Jules, she is often overwhelmed and fearful of the world, although compared with her sister, she seems more secure in her own mind, if not in her own skin. In a moment of self-love, Poppy adopts a three-legged dog named Amy Klobuchar. Tanner works wonders with little character development. I'd call it character entrenchment, and hardly any plot, trusting humor to structure the story all the way through. Eventually, Jules and Poppy go to Florida for Thanksgiving. The novel runs on an engine that relentlessly converts suffering, usually of the inner turmoil variety, into comedic relief. Speaking from experience, worry also nails what it was like to be a youngish media worker in Brooklyn in 2019, desperate for meaningful success in a crumbling industry, addicted to the fleeting dopamine hits of social media, online shopping, and clicking send on grant applications. It's funnier than it should be. There's reading tweet threads about Caroline Calloway and going to see a terrible adaptation of a Greek tragedy that knowingly references Uber. There's Callie sober and envisioning buying this one really ugly dress from Rachel Comey. These details inspire a potent mixture of familiarity and shame, like one of those compilations of photos your phone shows you about meals you just ate. In another aggressively 2019 moment, Jules decides to interview for a job writing horoscope content for an astrology app. Jules's interviewer, another would-be writer, asks her what getting an MFA was like. She considers being brutally honest, saying, "There's not much to tell about my MFA. Mostly I remember going to dark bars and magazine parties after class to try to meet nasty editors and glimpse obscure literary celebrities." In the end, Jules responds with a dash of generic writing advice packaged in a more optimistic anecdote, which never really happened, at least not to her. Some stories give you the unvarnished truth, some the varnished one. Worry is generous and wise enough to give you both. This review was written by Hannah Gold. She is a freelance critic for The Times. Olivetti by Allie Millington. Typewriters, the manually powered writing machines once made by Remington, Underwood, and Royal, are wondrous things. To see their magic in action, try this trick. Set a typewriter out on a table with a sheet of paper pre-rolled into its carriage and wait. Nearly every child and many adults will be drawn to the beauty and specificity of the machine. They will just have to type something, a thought, a complaint, a poem, a wish. The keys, knobs, and levers of typewriters were made to do one thing and one thing only, draw out words we each carry within us that have the potential to create meaning, achieve permanence. In her debut novel, Allie Millington takes such magic a step further. Her titular character, a mid-century lettera 22, called Olivetti after the company that made him, is a sentient, if stationary, being who, like so many teddy bears, action figures, and sock puppets in children's literature and pop culture, can worry, remember, love, and fear. Olivetti lives, which is a boon to the Brindle family, particularly their quietly troubled 12-year-old, Ernest. Good Lord, what 12-year-old boy isn't troubled? Ernest's parents have been sending him to a therapist, whom he calls Dr. Roundabout, because the doctor's questions go in circles. And how do you think you feel about how you think about how you're feeling? His place in the family pecking order, third of the four kids means his problems tend to be noted as afterthoughts. And his habit of isolating himself on the roof of their apartment building with his thick red Oxford English Dictionary, which he reads entry by entry, apologize, apology, apoplexy, apostle, apostrophe, is dismissed as antisocial behavior. Why can't he be enthralled with his phone like his siblings? Ernest is the brindle most burdened by cares and worries, not the least of which is everything that happened, a phrase he hears constantly from the adults in his life. Everything that happened is shorthand for an all-too-common family crisis that has already visited the Brindles. Then, when his mother, Beatrice Brindle, doesn't come home one afternoon, having vanished for no apparent reason, Ernest's life is thrown into a new disturbing chaos. Missing posters, visits with the police, his frazzled father's attempts to deal with way too much, his siblings squawking and fighting, conversations with the building's Brazilian super, the local librarian, and the owner of the corner pawn shop. The solid and pragmatic Quinn, daughter of the pawn shop's owner, is a welcome helpmate and foil for Ernest. She's a different kind of 12-year-old, a girl who has made peace with her own everything that happened. The novel is narrated, in alternating chapters, by Olivetti and Ernest. The Latera 22 takes the lead, introducing himself and steering the first three chapters. Olivetti has resided with the Brindles, a copper-colored family with eyes as rich as ink, he tells us, ever since Beatrice pulled him from a cardboard box and set him on her desk. For years, she has been recording her hopes and dreams on the vintage machine. Her tapestries, as she called them, not just because of the way she tried to weave her words into something beautiful and bigger, but because of all the noise we made together. Tap, tap, tap. Olivetti remembers every word he has typed. How could a typewriter forget what the human heart pours into its workings? Beatrice turned to Olivetti as one does to the perfect friend, who knows that listening is often the best thing a friend can do, even if that friend is a writing mechanism made in Italy in 1950. As such, Olivetti was the last one to see Beatrice before she disappeared. Millington captures the essence of why typewriters are such extraordinary creations and why everyone should have one. Olivetti takes no side, shakes no finger. A typewriter simply reflects what you put into it. And he cares. So when Ernest tracks down Olivetti, inexplicably pawned by Beatrice for $126, remember that amount, and begins tearfully typing on him, desperate to communicate with her, Olivetti does the unthinkable. He types back, "Do not be alarmed. I am Olivetti. I can help you." By communicating with a human being, he breaks the prime rule of all typewriters, to the horror of his pawn shop pal, Remy, a 1947 Remington Deluxe Model 5. But some humans, Olivetti assures us, are worth breaking the rules for. Millington's writing does us a great favor. Her Olivetti is neither an automaton nor a pushover. There is a painful and problematic crisis in the house he has called home, and his voice drives the action with compassion. Ernest speaks with a confusion and simmering panic recognizable to anyone who was once 12, loved their mother deeply, and feared for her life. The conclusion is nearly impossible to divine, and yet so perfect it includes that most tactile of memories, a 12-hour family road trip covering a distance of, well, $126. What comes after that exemplifies the best of Millington's literary imagination. The Brindles will go on confronting everything with hope, gusto, and all the unity they can muster. They will set the family table for 7, with a place for Olivetti, put paper in his carriage, and wait. This review was written by Tom Hanks, the actor, producer, director, and typewriter enthusiast. He is also the author of the story collection Uncommon Type and the novel The Making of Another Major Motion Picture Masterpiece. Fervor by Toby Lloyd. In one of the most perceptive of her late essays, God's Language, Toni Morrison sets out her objective as a novelist, to construct a work in which religious belief is central to the narrative itself. How, she asks, can the writer use the language religion has handed us in a way that the 21st century reader can hear? Not an easy task, but one that Toby Lloyd, in his magnificent, indelible debut novel, Fervor, takes on with confidence and with resounding success. Fervor begins with a relatively straightforward premise. After the death of Josef Rosenthal, a Holocaust survivor with a numbered tattoo on his arm, the precarious equilibrium of his family is shattered. But from the hushed grieving at the Rosenthal home outside London, the storylines only multiply and expand. Hannah, Josef's daughter-in-law, a provocative Zionist and the family's overbearing matriarch, writes about Josef's concentration camp experiences in a book, which is met with hostility and controversy. Hannah's daughter, Elsie, who sat at her grandfather's feet and internalized his life experiences, disappears for days. When she returns, her mother suspects she has become a witch. Elsie's brother, Tovia, gets into Oxford on his second try, and a substantial portion of the fervor of the book's title arises from his response to the extreme behavior of both his mother and his sister. A break from his shy, knowledgeable, defensive when provoked, but otherwise largely invisible nature. His sections are narrated by his closest friend at Oxford, Kate, a secular Jew who serves as a sounding board to Tovia in sections that bring to mind Absalom, Absalom, but with more generous paragraph breaks. This might all sound hopelessly complicated, and it might be in the hands of a lesser talent. For a writer as gifted as Lloyd, even potential missteps come to bear fruit. Early sections depicting Josef's last days are lyrical and moving. When Tovia sees his dead grandfather, we learn that he has seen a dead mouse flattened against the curb with blood pooling round its head, but he'd never seen a dead person. In evocations of holy texts from the Book of Judges to the Talmud to the Zohar, Lloyd has a remarkably light touch, bringing across complicated ideas with concision and precision. The esoterica of Kabbalah plays a central role throughout the book as a motivation for Elsie's strange and possibly supernatural behavior, and as the source of a figure in a loose white kaftan whom Kate sees and who might be a ghost and a counterpoint to the way Yosef's death serves less as a MacGuffin than as the wellspring from which the novel gains depth. In the final act of Fervor, Lloyd orchestrates a meeting of his main characters at the Rosenthal's house in scenes that echo the end of Philip Roth's American Pastoral. At a family dinner with everyone present, all the early promise of the novel comes to fruition. No spoilers here, but searching questions about the lasting influence of a Holocaust survivor, the shimmering play between realism and mysticism that the book has engaged with throughout, come to an ending that feels both surprising and inevitable. Also biblical, which puts me back in mind of that Toni Morrison essay, that a young British novelist on his first try should have so effectively taken up a gauntlet laid down by the greatest American novelist of an era, might seem surprising, but maybe not. We live in an age increasingly defined by the upending of well-established orders. Fervor, in its unpacking of a family after the loss of its Holocaust survivor patriarch, serves as a parable for the loss of a global accord created from the ashes of World War II. The book models the entropy that sets in when we forget why fragile harmonies are fashioned, however imperfectly, out of chaos. Enriching his story with detail and above all heart, Lloyd has crafted a lasting allegory of our dark historical time. This review was written by Daniel Tordet. His most recent novel is The 12th Commandment. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.